glad you tuned our way in this hour. Welcome back for, I think, the third visit. Dr. James B. Huey. Dr. Huey is a PhD, and he is a president of a group called Friendship. We'll talk about that for you a little bit later on. He also is in private practice as a family counselor. Jim, is family counselor okay? Is that...
Family psychologist probably would be more accurate.
Family psychologist. Glad to have you with us, by the way.
Well, thank you. It's always good to come back.
Last two times you were with us, Jim, you were out of Goldsboro, North Carolina. You now are headquartered in Atlanta.
Correct.
Why'd you move away from North Carolina?
Well, primarily the attraction was family. The family is still in Atlanta and to the south part of it. And that's just one of the things, as I get older, the attraction to family grows stronger.
Isn't that strange? You took the words right out of my mouth. I have, for the last, Jim, 4 or 5 years, had this sort of, and I guess it happens to all people when they reach a certain age. There's something running around in my head saying, you want to go home. You want to go home. And to be honest with you, I don't have a, quote, home. You know, there's nobody in my hometown that I could go back to and call my home. So does that happen to people when they reach 45, 50 years old and older?
A lot of
generally?
People in my peer group. I know, for example, my history is my father was in the Navy, so we didn't have a place to go
yeah,
to.
Yeah, you don't have a home.
But hometown really now is any place where there's family. Family members, good friends, those are the people that I want to be around.
Why is that now? Is there something in man and woman's nature that there is a nesting feeling, or you want to go home when you've done what you're going to do just about when you reach 45, 50, 55? You know, I'm talking about in your career. And you want to go back home and recapture your youth? What's the power that drives you?
Well, there's a unique nurturance at home that doesn't exist in any other type of relationship. It's a very unique kind of nurturing. It's a strength. Also, because of you getting to this stage in life where people are starting to die. Mm. And you go back to kind of like make the complete circle. Go back home where there's extra strength.
You know, it's interesting you should mention that. Recently, I guess maybe 4 or 5 months ago, a couple of my very good friends, I guess my two best friends in the world, and I decided we'd go back to our hometown. One now lives in South Carolina, one lives in Raleigh, and I live here. And we met and went back and went to some of the old places and messed around. And we all confessed at the lunch table that day when we had lunch together, we're reading the obituary columns. And we used to laugh at our mothers and daddies. Why do you read that? Who wants to know who's dead? But now you read to see if that's somebody of your age, I guess.
And also the ones who are younger.
Oh, that's a bit scarier, isn't it?
It is. It is. But it's kind of reassuring to us to go and see the ones who are dying, but also the ones who are still not there yet. People like myself and colleagues, friends, so forth, who are still here. And that is nurturing.
Is there a point in a person's life, and it may not be a calendar, a chronological point, but is there a point in most everybody's life when they start facing mortality? Because when you're 25, 30, 18, you don't think you're ever going to die. You really don't. Abstractly, yes, you know that there's death out there somewhere, but you don't think you're going to die or even get hurt seriously.
Well, and that's one of the characteristics of adolescence. That's why so much of their behavior is so unpredictable and so almost self-destructive and risk-taking, because they really don't see death as affecting them. It is only when we start getting older and realize some body functions may start slowing down a little bit, or we recognize that people are dying and are not going to be with us. Then we start saying, hey, you know, death is not only an abstract, it's not only an intellectual pursuit, it's real. And then, what am I going to do with the rest of my life? Yeah. Not the existential of adolescence, why am I alive and what am I going to do? But as we get older, it's more like, what have I accomplished? What do I want to do in the time that God has given me?
And that is a gift from God, you think? I think it is.
I believe
that you can introspectively look at yourself and say, hey, not too bad, but there's some things you need to do yet.
Well, the thing is, I expect to die with a lot of things undone. I mean, I certainly have no intention of ever attaining perfection on earth. But I want to strive to accomplish all the things that I can do with the gifts and talents that God has given me.
When you are around someone who has lost someone, and I'm particularly thinking about young mothers or young fathers who've lost infants, babies, what is your advice on how to handle that? I mean, what words should you say, or should you use any words? Should you just pat them on the arm and say, I'm here? Or are there magic golden words that can make their lives a little easier in that time of trial?
I think one of the greatest myths, Henry, probably is the fact that so many people waste a lot of energy trying to find magical golden words for any number of situations. I'm a firm believer in each one of us being the unique creation that we are. And sometimes when a person is hurting and I am with them, something I can say can be helpful. And then other times, it's very, very appropriate to just be quiet and be with them.
Let them know I'm here.
Right.
Really? Well, now, can you be harmful? Can you say something perfectly innocent and make their bereavement deeper? Can you say something like, I hate this term, but you hear it all the time, and I've used it myself. I'm not pointing fingers. Well, maybe they're better off. That's not very comforting, is it? That's almost negative, isn't it?
I believe that you have a lot more chance to say something negative if you speak than if you are quiet and be with the person.
Yeah.
Then you don't put your foot in the mouth. And in psychology, one of my guiding creeds is, above all, do no harm. I may not be able to really offer you what you need, but first and foremost, as a psychologist, I am going to be there but not do anything that I believe may or may cause a harm to you.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That's important to me.
Dr. James Hugh is with us, and I think you can feel his positiveness. He has been in the past a lecturer and a teacher and has done some private practice. Now is in full private practice in Atlanta, Georgia, as a family psychologist. He also has what he calls friendship. I want you to explain what friendship is to the folks.
Basically, friendship is the belief that we go through life and very few times do we have a chance to study who we are, what we value, what we believe, who are the unique human beings that we are created to be. Most of us are taught by parents, teachers, authorities as to what we should be, but very seldom do we get a chance to really listen to ourselves. And I think the key concept of friendship is offering listening hospitality, offering an environment where someone can come and be themselves. We're in a culture where we value talking. I mean, very seldom do you hear a listen radio. When you started at the last hour, you said, you know, if you want to talk, we'll just listen to you. And I said, now that's the spirit of friendship, because that is the key. If you want to talk, and most people, I believe, do want to share, do want to learn about themselves, friendship is there to offer a listening hospitality. We care to offer an atmosphere where someone can dare to be themselves. Say the things they can't say to their friends, they can't say to their family. They can be open and honest.
What causes loved ones or really good friends not to be able to say, here's what I'm really feeling, here's where I'm hurting, I want you to hear me? Why can't they say that? They can say it to you, they can say it to me, they can say it to perfect strangers. Why can't they say it to someone that loves them and they love? What's that barrier?
A while back, a fellow named John Powell wrote a book called Why Am I Afraid to Tell You Who I Am? And the answer in the book was that if I tell you who I am, you may not like it.
Wow.
So therefore,
wow, that's a fear then, Jim?
This is basically a fear that many of us have. We build up a facade, an expectation of behaviors that's saying, Henry, if I really tell you who James Huey is, that you're not going to like me, you're not going to appreciate me, you're not going to value my opinions, you might want to fire me, you might want to kick me out of the family reunion, you might want to, if I had a belief that, say, didn't agree with the church may want to throw me out.
Mm-hmm.
Any number of thoughts that I as a human being could have. So what do? I build an elaborate facade. Things that will help me say, this is who James Huey is, and if you don't like the blue coat I have on, then I'll go home and put on a brown coat or a green coat or whatever you need, because I want to be liked.
So James, it's not so much that people put us in pigeonholes. We put ourselves in pigeonholes thinking that's what they think of us.
Correct.
Here's what I think you think I am.
And one of the biggest things about personal retreating and the whole process of therapy and counseling is recognizing that most of the cells we have locked ourselves into, the lock and key are on the inside.
Hmm.
It isn't outside. It isn't the new job. It isn't the spouse. It isn't the family. It's inside. It's inside of us.
Yeah.
And one of the things is to create an atmosphere where we can reach in, find the right key, and let ourselves out, be who we are.
Dr. Huey, go back, if you would, to family relationships. How long have you been in practice, may I ask? 20 years, 15 years, 10 years?
It has been 24 years since I received my doctorate.
Okay, in those years, and even before, in cases you've read about, in books you've read, and people you've talked to who are older in the same business, has the family really changed in the Southeast in America? Has the family really changed the structure and the way they look at things and the way they view things and the cohesion or lack of it?
Well, yesterday morning in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, I was reading a statistic that now the number of adults, single parents with children, now is equal the same number of households in the Atlanta area as married couples.
And that didn't happen 50 years
ago. That did not
happen. Very rare, very rare.
Very rare. In fact, it almost took death for one member of a couple to leave.
What does that say to you? Is there a cause and effect that you can put your finger on, or are there so many you can't single out one?
I believe we live in a very diverse and complex society. The world is changing. And one of the things, as I get older, I dislike change. I like things to be predictable. I like things to be familiar. I probably can identify with a number of my clients in that regard. But things are changing around as we're becoming much more global. Now, I can remember when they had, the TV picture of New York and San Francisco and the first time. And wow, what a wonder that was.
It's amazing.
And now
Ed Murrow was talking to someone live in San Francisco.
Right.
And we thought, wow,
isn't that exciting?
Yeah.
And it's a real change. I was coming through a section that I said, boy, it must be rough around here at night. And we were talking with a colleague and I was saying, you know, when we were children, we could just walk to town. There was absolutely no apprehension, no fear. The world is changing in a number of ways, and it's difficult for us as a family because we have a belief the way it should be. That's just a characteristic. We really believe things, and that's why I say one of the real goals of counseling is to confront what are the shoulds that we have, what are the oughts, what are the things that we believe ought to be a certain way and aren't, or have changed. Just because they're different, sometimes we think they're worse.
Now, that's a political way of answering my question. In your heart of hearts, do you think we are worse off as a society in 1993 than we were in 1953?
In some ways we are, and in some ways we're better. In other words, right now, for example, divorce is high, and in some cases I have worked with people where getting divorced was one of the best things for the family that could have happened. And other times where it's divorce, oh, well, if it doesn't work out, we'll live together 6 months and see. I think those are unhealthy things for the family.
But surely, even with your optimistic viewpoint, we are a more violent society than we were 40 years ago, 50 years ago. People don't sit on their front porches anymore. They do at their own danger, if they do. They don't go shopping at Piggly Wiggly and leave their door open at home. They don't sleep with their windows open if they can possibly avoid it. And for good reasons. First of all, do you agree we're a more violent society than we were 40
years ago? I agree we are.
Why are we?
A very generic answer, Henry, probably is that I believe we're a more heterogeneous society than we were when I was a child.
Explain that term.
More diverse. In other words, we have more cultures, we have much more attitudes, we have faster communication. When I grew up, living in the town of Gaffney, right across the line in South Carolina, well, everybody stayed in Gaffney. They were born, raised, and died in Gaffney.
And you knew them all. They knew you.
We knew everybody. You knew every time anybody new would come to town, it would almost be an event kind of thing. Now, I live in an apartment complex, and I don't know most of the people who live in the same building, much less the other 23 buildings.
So you're likely, as a human being, to do violence to someone you don't know?
Very much so.
Than you're someone you do know and respect?
Well, and also, a lot of us, I believe, have this alienated feeling from our culture, from our society. In other words, in the days of the 50s, we had a chance to build bonds. We had a chance to talk to one another. We had some identification with churches. We had some identification with the town political system. And now there's so many people who are alienated and angry. They really feel distant from the political system. They're cynical. Conspiracy theories just run rampant. You just mentioned one, and more people are likely to believe it now than they would have, I believe, 40 years ago.
Let me open up a whole new subject, if you don't mind. In your opinion, do we need something greater than ourselves to believe in? If you don't call him God, you call it something else. Do we need something that's greater than ourselves to believe in?
I believe for most of us it is. I have a hesitancy with the word always and never. Those are just too absolutist for me. But I believe that most people need something to believe in. And at one continuum, it may generally believe in something outside of themselves, such as the universal spirit, God, etc. At the other extreme, it may be a complete belief internally. In other words, I as a human being, a kind of very humanistic philosophy. I believe, personally, that it's a branch between the two. In other words, I believe God gave us a mind, he gave us a heart, he gave us feelings to use, not to just store away and to take something entirely external. But I don't believe as a human being that I can operate in the world without a spirit, without some input from other people. I know I'm a social animal, and I need and I thrive on interactions with other people. And I find that for most people. I wouldn't say all, but I would say that most of the people I know.
Yeah. Our number is 570-1110. Dr. James Huey, a family psychologist, is with us. So we want to participate and let you participate. Caller, hi. Thanks for holding. You're on the air.
You were talking about as you get older, you perhaps want to go back home.
Mm-hmm.
Well, after 41 years of marriage, we are separated only 10 months. And I'm thinking seriously about, should I go back where I used to live when I grew up? All my brothers and sisters and my mother are still there.
Well, you're very lucky in that, aren't you?
Yes.
Yeah.
But here I am, way out here in the eastern part of the States, and all of my family are back west.
When you say west, you mean Western America or Western North Carolina?
Western United States.
I got you. Okay, fine. And you're asking Dr. Huey for some advice?
Yes.
Doctor, how can you help her?
Well, my first question to you, I guess turning a question with a question, is what would you hope to find when you went back home?
That's a great question.
Family. It's a close-knit family.
Would you be expecting them to become an active part of your life and you to become an active part of their lives, for example?
Not so much active as there if needed, I suppose.
So to be available.
Yes.
Would you find that going back you would have the necessary wherewithal to find friends outside the family? Would you be interested in finding support other than the family?
Oh, definitely. Definitely, because I'm a very active person.
Well, those would be two things based on interaction with other people that I would encourage you.
Uh-huh.
One is, what do you expect to find at home? Because many people go back and they want to find the home of 40 years ago.
When she was a young girl.
And it's not. It's not there.
Mm-hmm.
The people have changed. You have changed. So I encourage you to be aware of, am I going home with the reality of the relationships, the expectations of my family? Am I going home to go back into the womb of being supported by them rather than to become an adult member of a collective? That's different than when you were a child. If you can see it in a more idea of a fellowship, a collective community, then I think you have a much better chance. And the second is that if you are interested in collecting support other than the family, then I think you have a much better chance of a healthy transition.
When you say support, Dr. Huey, what do you mean by that word?
By church or by friends or by social groups.
A network and connection.
Correct.
Okay.
Many people go back and they want the family to take care of them. They want to be...
No, that's not what I want at all. As a matter of fact, I wouldn't want to be right there in the middle of it all, but close enough.
If you want to be close enough, then you're going to have to set the criteria for yourself, because they're already there.
Yes.
They're going to react to you.
It's just so far.
Caller Henry, how do you feel in your heart of hearts? Would you be happy going back to home? Or is that what you're trying to determine?
Well, that's what I'm trying to determine.
Yeah.
So I won't do anything right away, because they say don't make any decisions within the first year or two. So,
well, one of the two things that's possible, of course, one is a kind of visitation to see. That is certainly one opportunity.
Nice long vacation, 2 or 3 weeks or something like that.
A long time in the area.
Yeah, not a bad idea.
And it's certainly a lot cheaper than moving. It really is.
Not a bad suggestion.
And the other thing I would encourage you to do is talk with your friends who are here. In other words, one of the things we do is we learn about ourselves by sharing it verbally with other people. And having friends who are going to ask you the kinds of questions that would fit uniquely you. Not your neighbor, not someone down the street, but friends who know you and can ask you the pointed questions so that you can make the appropriate decision.
Wow. Good advice, it sounds like to me.
Thank you.
And it sounds like you're a nice, nice, level-headed lady, too. Good luck to you.
Thank you.
What you decide will be right, I'll bet you.
Thanks
for calling. Bye-bye. I have had one experience with a class reunion. It was not a bad experience, but it was not the pleasurable, happy experience I wanted it to be. In other words, the people who came back were not the people I remembered when I left. And that's what you're talking about now. My expectations were wrong. Is that what the problem might have been?
Well, I know they were wrong, but they set you up for frustration and disappointment. one of the real challenges, I believe, for us as human beings is to set realistic expectations, not being negative, not discounting ourselves, but recognizing that a certain period of time has changed. I have changed, and my world has changed, whether it's a hometown or a reunion or even a friend that I haven't seen for a period of time.
Sure.
There is always a change. Change is constantly occurring. And many of us want to stop it by setting up an expectation of the way things should be, the way they ought to be. And when it doesn't work that way, we get either anxious, we get depressed, we get very frustrated with ourselves and the world.
That's exactly what was wrong with me, I think. You hit it on the head. I wanted Perry, my old pal Perry, to can you continue the conversation we ended back in 1953. I wanted my pal Barbara to remember that day in the lunchroom in 1952. And they had whole new lives. They didn't have no idea what I was talking about. They didn't have the same memory I had. Mm-hmm. And I expected them to. I was putting my expectations over them, wasn't I?
And they may have been putting their expectations on you.
Yeah.
And wondering, why in the world aren't you meeting my need?
Well, now, how do you handle that better? How do you handle reunions or church homecomings or family get-togethers, people you haven't seen in a number of years? How do you handle that? How do you approach it? How do you handle it once you're there? How do you say goodbye again?
Well, the old cliche, one day at a time, one step at a time, meaning I'm going to a reunion and I'm going to do a journey. I'm going to see who's there. I'm going to see what is there. I'm going to see how I feel once I'm there. For example, I can go to a reunion and I say, this is going to be a period of time where I'm going to interact with people who were important in my life. Now, are they still important? I don't know the answer to that. If I set myself up an expectation, then they're not important, I get one set of reactions.
If I say they should be important because they were important 20 years ago, then I'm setting myself up for other frustrations. I'm encouraging, once again, the journey approach, which is saying, I'm going to go and I'm going to see what happens. I'm going to experience it. I'm going to go and feel and meet. I may not have liked X, Y in a certain 20 years ago, but now, hey, you know, they've done something different with their lives. They have evolved. They maybe have found faith, or maybe they've actually gone through therapy or something. Or maybe they climbed Mount Everest. Who knows what they've done, but they're different. And I like the difference as versus someone else who may look the same as they did 40 years ago, but you have changed and they're not interesting anymore.
Mm-hmm. And maybe I'm not interesting anymore.
Maybe you are.
Yeah.
But it's setting up some expectations where you feel comfortable just taking the journey.
But let me ask you something that I'll bet you does affect a lot of people listening. If you are living in your family in a situation where it just isn't working, for whatever reason, it's not a good marriage. You're working in a job that for whatever reason, whether it's your fault or your boss's fault or whatever, it's just not right. Something is not right and it's not a good job. If you're in a school and you're just out of place, that's the wrong school for you, you shouldn't be there. You're in a church, a synagogue, in the same situation. What do you do? Is the first thing to recognize, well, there is a problem? Is that the first step?
Well, one of the things I really encourage people to do is be aware of what they do feel. In other words, so often we live in a world that encourages people to deny what they feel, to block it out, to repress it, and to put on a happy face and go forward. In other words, even if the marriage stinks, even if the job is terrible, to put on a happy face, be strong, and always be cheerful.
Now, you're saying that's good, or you're saying
that's what happens.
That's our mechanism.
So what I'm encouraging people to do is to fight that by learning and getting in touch with what they, one, really do feel. The second is any change is going to require that price that you and I have talked about over the previous conversations. Mm-hmm. It's going to cost some either money or emotional capital, financial capital, spiritual capital, social costs that are involved in making change. The biggest mistake I find for most people is they want to change the environment. They want to change the boss. They want to change their spouse. They want to change the family. It's just like somebody who's wanting to change something external. I encourage people to recognize that has severe limitations. The second and the most difficult part is what are they going to change about themselves? Is this a relationship that I am willing to pay the price of being in this relationship with the spouse who is defective, dysfunctional in some form or fashion? If they are, then that's the choices they will make. If they're not,
then what are the options? And one of them, I firmly believe, is not trying to do it all by themselves. I believe very strongly in prayer. I believe very strongly in talking with friends. I believe very strongly in finding someone who cares about you and will listen to you, because the answer is in us. I really believe that.
But what does that do then if you spread out your discomfort to your family, to your minister, to your rabbi, to your friends, to your counselors? How does that help you if you spread out your misery?
Well, hopefully it's spread in a form that people will, once again, listen to you, will share their perceptions, not advice, because I think that's one of the worst things that can be done is to give the advice.
Listen to me.
But listen to me. What am I saying? What am I feeling? In other words, someone asked me, you know, if I stay put in this apartment, then it's going to cost so much. If I move, it's going to cost so much. My reaction is, I'm hearing you say, you don't want to make the change.
Yeah, yeah.
You don't want to make the change. And that happens in relationships, too.
We have one question we didn't want to come on the air. How does Dr. Hewitt feel about support groups? Can you become too dependent on support groups?
I feel very strongly, and that's one of the things that I believe has been an improvement in our culture, that we do recognize we need other people. And a lot of us don't have the extended family that we once had, and now we need support groups. Also because more knowledge can be learned by interacting with other people. Other people have had different experiences. I'm a firm believer in support groups. Having said that, I'm also aware of the caller's implication, and that is that anything, we can become too addicted to it. We can believe that support groups are the answer. They're not. They're one of many resources.
They're not prop-up groups. They're support groups.
Hopefully they are. If they are run in a way that is meaningful for the participants, they become support. They do not become answer groups. They do not become the outcome, but they become part of the journey.
Dr. James B. Huey, H-U-G-H-E-Y, has been our guest. Jim, it's always good to see you. Thanks for coming.
Thank you for having me, Henry.
Thank you, my friend. Have a great weekend. WBT in Charlotte, 80 degrees. Open phones in the next hour. It's 10 o'clock.